Welcome to the ITE Talks Transportation Podcast from the Institute of Transportation Engineers. Each month, we'll bring you conversations with thought leaders in transportation on the future of the industry. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the ITE Talks Transportation Podcast. I'm your host, Bernie Wagenblast.
Community engagement has become an integral part of most transportation projects. While public input is mandated by law or policy in many cases, our guest, Odessa Philip, says the value goes much deeper. Odessa is the president and CEO of Aceto Consulting. She was part of a panel at last year's ITE annual meeting that looked at people-centered mobility. Today, we'll hear her thoughts on what makes for effective community engagement. Odessa, welcome to ITE Talks Transportation.
Thank you, Bernie, for having me on the call.
I want to start off talking about community involvement and engagement. Now, that's something that, for the most part, years and years ago, was really not part of the transportation planning process. But more recently, it has become a very important and critical component of both transportation decision-making and land use planning. So let me ask you, what's been your experience in the evolution of community involvement and engagement?
This is such a great question. So when I think about the evolution, I'm probably about 25 years into this business. And when I first started doing community engagement, it was as a project engineer, still doing design work, and being asked to sit in on this public meeting. And the way that that was kind of tossed to me, it was, this is a nuisance, but we have to do it. And I was there in this meeting. And this was actually one of those formative things, because I didn't know when I sat in on this meeting as a project engineer that I was going to one day do this full time. That evolution, though, has looked like we just need to do this to check a box. And then it became, well, we can check the box, but we should also probably get a few more voices in the conversation. But no, we don't want it to be inconvenient to us. And then it transitioned a little bit further from there to, okay, well, maybe we can be a little inconvenienced and maybe do a Saturday or a Saturday morning or an afternoon every now and then, just because we want to get more participation. And then now full-fledged, what are all the ways we can get people in the room? Can we do virtual? Can we do a meeting on a Sunday? Can we go to people's community meetings? We stopped that thought process of making it convenient for us as practitioners and move to making it convenient for the public as the people impacted by the work.
You touched on this, but looking at what we learned from COVID, obviously COVID changed commuting patterns. You know, after a period of nobody going anywhere, all the commuting being virtual, people are back in the office, but not to the same extent they were pre-COVID. How has that COVID experience impacted the community involvement process? What have the agencies learned? How have things changed post-COVID?
I think people learned a lot more than they expected. And I'm saying both communities and agencies learned a lot. Communities learned that they could actually have a voice in projects. I think they didn't really recognize how much of an opportunity they had to really weigh in pre-COVID. COVID opened up some doors with virtual engagement that people who had never participated before could participate. So I think the most notable, and I've heard community members say this to me when I'm on these virtual meetings with them, is before we had these in-person meetings and they had to put off cooking dinner for the family. And now, in a virtual meeting, they're in their house, they're cooking the dinner for their kids, they are still able to check homework and do those things that are really important for being a part of the parental or family unit, but also able to take that same time to be an active part of the transportation infrastructure. and what's going to happen near their homes. So I think the biggest thing that changed was that virtual engagement element and people's willingness to use it. So the one thing I will say is virtual engagement existed pre-COVID. Participation in it was not as high. And then post-COVID, I have no meetings where people don't ask, is there a virtual option or a hybrid option available to us that we can use? So that's been probably the biggest change. What do I think we've learned? I think we've all learned or gotten confirmation that one size doesn't fit all. We were doing years upon years, you know, as practitioners, we were saying, hey guys, one size doesn't fit all, right? Low income or minority communities may be working two jobs, right? Low income communities, a person might be working a second or third shift at the third shift. And when we have a meeting at 6 p.m., that might be the start of that second shift. And I think everyone learned or started to hear about the third shift and started to appreciate that those differences were important. And those are critical differences for transportation infrastructure, right? Transportation and travel patterns at all hours of the day are changing. And we really don't have access to that information when we only operate at one time a day for public engagement efforts.
You mentioned you've had about 25 years experience in this field. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges and biggest opportunities when it comes to community involvement?
I probably have two big challenges. One is getting people to believe that they can actually affect change by participating. And there's an opportunity as practitioners, and I'm talking transportation engineers, to get better designs by really meaning it when we say we want public engagement. So a lot of times we say we have to have it. And we stop trying to get what we really want, which is real meaningful input from the community, because that's going to be a time impact or a budget impact. But I remember, and this was 10 plus years ago, I guess, working on the Intercounty Connector, which is a highway here in Maryland that connects two counties. And we had a community member come up with a design idea that because we had an open-minded project director, we listened to the community member, we ended up implementing their idea. The contractor, the designer went back, it was a design build contract, and they went back and made an adjustment that saved them maybe $500,000 with this person's idea. And when you think about it, if you give people, and these are bright people, but he's just an ordinary guy, you have an opportunity to have some design improvements that can be cost savings, but they also build so much trust, right, with the community. And that's the part that I think is the biggest opportunity for us. When you have an open mind, and we all know this across all sorts of things, when you have an open mind, you have the opportunity to be, you know, amazed by the ingenuity of people. And so there's this opportunity to have real exciting ideas that are community supported when you let the community really weigh in. So that's kind of what I think the opportunity is.
We talk about virtual meetings. That's just one aspect of some of the digital tools that are being used when it comes to involving the public. Can you talk a little bit about some of the best practices or maybe some of the worst practices that you've seen when it comes to using digital tools in community involvement and engagement when it comes to transportation planning?
So I remember being a young engineer, and one of the things they tell you is when you're working on doing coding or you're entering things in a database, it's garbage in, garbage out. It's the same risk with digital tools. If you don't ask people, as an example, the right question in a survey, you can end up with answers that are skewed, right? And this is well proven when you look at statistics and when people are doing that kind of statistical analysis on information. When we ask the wrong questions, we get the wrong answers, but it might be the answer we've led people to because of it. And I see that often happening in digital engagement, and that's something that we have to be very cautious of. Time needs to be spent developing the tool to think about all of the ways in which you should use the tool. Why are we developing it? What is its purpose? How is it going to be used? How's the data that's collected going to be used? And then how can we make sure that we avoid the garbage out by not putting in garbage, right? Not getting it, the bad pieces in. And then when you ask me about virtual meetings, I'm probably the last holdout. I'm not a fan of hybrid meetings. I think virtual engagement is a terrific thing. It's a great tool. We needed it. It's an asset to us all. Hybrid meetings, though, are extremely tough to deliver because often you're not delivering to the in-person or the virtual audience the level that you intend to. You want to make sure that people feel like they're getting an opportunity to be heard. And with hybrid meetings, you typically are not giving both groups the right amount of participation. So you're not paying attention to one or the other as much as you should. In order to do a hybrid meeting, and I think most of my clients and most government agencies are going to hate what I say, but in order to do it, it's basically costing you double. Because I have to assign a facilitator and staff to manage the chat and the interaction online or in that virtual room that are doing the exact same level of engagement as the people who are doing it in person. So while we have done hybrid meetings, when I have watched other people's, I've gone to other people's hybrid meetings, I see the challenge, right? Somebody does not feel like they are actively involved in the process. So I think there is a lot of work that needs to be done to refine the hybrid experience so that all of the participants feel properly engaged in it.
We'll continue our discussion with Odessa Phillip right after this message on ITE Talks Transportation.
Do you want to reach more than 17,000 transportation professionals? Podcasts like this one are a great way to reach a dedicated audience of listeners. Sponsoring an ITE podcast is a cost-effective way to gain exposure and build brand awareness. ITE offers podcasts on key issues like safety, connected and automated vehicles, and transportation management systems and operations, ensuring your message is heard by the right people. For more information, contact Jill Andrew at the Wyman Company. Her email is jandreu at the Wyman Company, WYMAN.com.
When it comes to these kinds of engagements with the community, if a client comes to you and says, how do we know if this worked? How do we measure the effectiveness of this? What would your answer be to them?
The very first thing I will say is, I should have told you that at the beginning. So when we're starting engagement, we think about how are we going to tell if this is working or not. Most programs, we do a public involvement plan, so they call it a PIP. We start with that very intentionally so that we can think about what are our goals. I think when you think as a technical person, you think about KPIs, those key performance indicators. Public engagement has to have the same thing. You have to have decided up front what those key performance indicators are, and then you use that as measures of effectiveness. So as an example, when we do public meetings, we think about, okay, is it more important that we have 100 people in the room or that we have 40 people from this particular community in the room, right? And we use that as our measure of effectiveness. So if we decided we're having a meeting and there are 100 people there and none of them are from the targeted community, we weren't successful. So we do things like that. So it's not just how many people are in the room, but are they the right people? Do we have the right people in the room? So we have to ask questions when people are coming into the room to kind of determine whether we're meeting our performance indicator. That's one that most people do. We think about social media the same way. You've got to be really, really thoughtful about you're putting out an image. Does this image mean, or do the words with that image mean the same in English as in Spanish, as in Portuguese, as in French, right? Are we thinking through all of the audiences that we need to reach when we develop the materials so that it does not inadvertently offend or dismiss one of our non-English language audience members that may be a really key participant in the process. We also have to say it didn't work. And when it didn't work, we have to come up with another plan. And a lot of times, we're never tracking or measuring or assessing whether it worked or not. So our team spends a lot of time thinking about, well, did it work? And what was the goal? And did we successfully achieve that goal? And we use that. And that's how we tell our clients. So if we hadn't told them up front what our plan was, then we're already probably behind. And then secondly, if we did tell them and we see that it didn't work, we have to be willing to say, hey, we thought this was going to work, but it absolutely didn't. And here's our plan B so that we can find another way to check it.
After decades of transportation decision-making not taking equity into major consideration, that is now something that is front and center on virtually all decisions when it comes to transportation. How do we make sure that these kinds of decisions are being done equitably and that the agencies are doing things in the community outreach process that assure some level of equity as far as feedback is concerned? You talked a little bit about materials being in languages that mean the same thing in other languages than English, but tell me a little bit more about that.
Equity is tough because it's a core value, I think, for most agencies, and it's a core value for people, even though they don't necessarily know it. They didn't look at it that way in the beginning. In order to do things equitably, in order to infuse that equity into processes, you have to think of the process first. And we have to do a little bit of dissection of what we were doing before and say, well, what were the outcomes of what we had? So we recently started working on a project for a client, and they were very surprised that in every survey that we send out, we ask demographic questions. And so the client, there's a pretty diverse county. And so I was surprised when they were surprised that we always include these questions. They said, no, we've never asked these questions. And I said, well, then how do you know that you've reached the audience that you were intending to reach with the survey? And they say, oh, well, we asked like address questions, right? Do you live in the neighborhood, kind of by zip code? And I said, but let's just say we're doing a pedestrian study. And we know in this area, there is a very high incident of pedestrian crashes with non-English speaking and immigrant populations. If the people who are doing the survey are all doing it in English, and they're all doing that survey within the same zip code, do you know that you've reached your target audience, which are the people who are crossing the street and making maybe a cultural difference? They're doing something culturally that they would do, but that doesn't really work well with our roadway network. You don't know. You won't know if you haven't asked a demographic question. So we've strategized on how to do that smarter. One of the ways that you can do that smarter is to say, ask demographic questions, but then explain to people why you're asking that demographic question. We are wanting to make sure we're hitting the audience that this really is affecting. And so we've got to be extremely transparent with people about why we ask questions. And that's how you get to the equity outcomes. You tell people why you're doing it. You tell them how it's going to be better because you're doing it. And then at the end of it, you say, and this is why it was better. Don't you see? We did this, this, and this because we knew that we had reached our target audience. And we knew that we needed to translate this into four languages because that was the demographic here. We knew that we could not forget to include visually impaired and blind individuals in pedestrian crash information at an area where there's a very bad problem with free right turns. Those kinds of considerations come from taking apart our old processes and putting back together something that puts all of the voices in the room that have never been heard.
Can you give us some examples from your experience of community involvement and engagement practices that worked well, that you've learned from and others can learn from?
What we have found works well is transparency. I think that's what I was just alluding to. We had a project here in Maryland, in Hyattsville, Maryland, where we were working on a master plan that we needed to make sure, and that the population of that particular city is very high Spanish speaking. And we wanted to be smarter about how we did the work. And so what we did was had a native Spanish speaker in our virtual engagement, and there was a Spanish speaking only room. And I thought that was tremendous because there was not this attempt to translate English to Spanish, the conversation. So we had a planner who was a Spanish speaker leading the engagement. Our client had a Spanish speaking project manager. And so they did the Spanish speaking room alone. And then I facilitated the English speaking room. So we kind of allowed all of the voices to be separated. And sometimes I don't believe in separation, right? Because sometimes you separate and other people don't hear important things. But in this case, we let voices that typically are not heard get their own space to be able to speak. I thought it worked tremendously well. The people who participated were excited that they had that option. The elected officials representing that district were excited that they could say there was a Spanish-speaking only room that was being involved. And this was in the height of COVID. So I thought that was just one of those things that worked really well. And we've offered that to clients several times since then. And sometimes, depending on the project and depending on where we were and whether the demographics made sense, we've done that and people have been really appreciative. There was no need to try to translate the answers back to English so that the project team could understand. And I just found that to be exciting. And I've watched when we've had engagements and there was a person who just spoke Spanish in the room talking to Spanish speakers as they were walking around the same meeting boards. And the body language was just exuberant with, I don't have to try to figure out what's happening. I know that this is for me. And when we talk about equity and we talk about making sure everybody feels like they have a voice, when you feel like the engagement is designed for you to participate, you increase participation.
Even when you've done everything right in terms of you've reached the audience that you want to reach, the materials are near perfect, one of the challenges still is the audience saying, yeah, okay, I'll share my opinion, but it's really not going to make any difference. This decision has already been made. Yeah. How do you counteract that? And how do you assure people that their voices really do make a difference as far as the project is concerned and how it's going to be laid out?
It's difficult because a lot of times we're doing engagement too late. So one of the things that we do that I believe in is I talk to my clients early about we need voices at a point in the design process where they can actually make an impact. And then when we do take that feedback and it does make a difference or we change things, we then have to communicate how community voices affected and changed a design. And it's one project at a time in a jurisdiction. So you have to do that over and over and over again before people believe it. So the first time you do it, that's not enough time. The second time you do it, it's not enough. It is the 10th time that they see that you said, I want to get your voices. You actually listen. You couldn't change everything, but oh my gosh, the facade is made of wood paneling instead of steel. They tell that story for you if you've successfully done it. When you haven't successfully done it, when you haven't reached out, you can't tell a success story. And then people say, see, I just came here, I've wasted my time. So I really, really challenge people to know why they're doing the engagement, to ask those tough questions, figure out really how can the community change it. And if the community can't change it, tell them that upfront. We've got to say transparently, this is an informational meeting, not an input meeting. And be willing to take the hit, because sometimes there's a hit for that, right? But we have to be willing to take the hit from the community that, yeah, they're not going to be happy about it. They thought they had a chance to have a voice. But then when they do have an opportunity to have a voice, we have to jump on it and do something with their voice so that they really can have the success they need.
As we wrap up, Odessa, I want to ask you about what you see as some of the emerging trends in community involvement. And what excites you when you look to the future about things that are happening or maybe are on the verge of happening when it comes to community involvement?
Oh my gosh. I love the fact that we are getting more and more willing to hear everyone's voice and figure out how you hear a lot of voices. I watch my parents as they've aged, and my father passed, but my mom has moved from a dentist and a very active physical body into one that's older, that needs a walker, that needs a parking space for her, that allows her to get out of her car and maneuver. And our engagement now thinks, well, what about seniors? And what about people who have limited movement, right? For limited mobility for any number of reasons. That excites me. It excites me that agencies are requiring that we don't consider engagement just a box check anymore, but it is part of the process. It's just part of the fabric of transportation. And then the transportation projects are changing, right? What I feel we're starting to see are transportation projects that really do consider the needs of people. Ultimately, the reason I do the work that I do is because people don't always know what they need because they weren't necessarily educated in the transportation or in engineering. And so they need someone who says, hey, it's important to get their voices involved in the conversation. And so I really cherish the fact that our engagement is feeling more honest. I think for years and years, engagement didn't feel honest. And I would always have to try to justify why a client didn't do some specific thing. And I'm not doing that anymore. I have more clients that really believe that they want to do the right thing. And I spend less time being called in to fix a project that didn't do engagement early. And instead, I'm at the forefront of projects. I'm working on projects where, and my firm is working on projects where engagement professionals are in the rooms with the highest level of stakeholders in it, you know, from agencies. It's the directors, it is the executive directors. We're part of those conversations. And that is what excites me the most about where engagement is going, is that we're putting it where it belongs and we're putting people at the forefront of infrastructure projects.
My guest on this episode of ITE Talks Transportation has been Odessa Philip. She is the president and CEO of Aceto Consulting. Odessa, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you so very, very much for the opportunity.